next speaker doesn't really need an introduction because I'm sure everybody knows John Rowan, and I'm delighted to invite him to speak for us this morning.
Okay. I'm going to use this, so I want to check that this is all right for you.
Yes.
All right? Good. I'm going to have to talk into the end of it like this, so that's what I'm doing. Let's hope it works all right. This is my complete script here, so... I had a very long one, but Andrew talked me out of it, and so I'm doing a quite different one. First of all, I want to tell you about humanistic psychology. I was in on the beginning of humanistic psychology in this country, and so I've got a sort of unique take on it in a way. The Association for Humanistic Psychology in Britain was actually founded in 1969, but I only discovered it in 1970. So I've been in it ever since. 70 was my sort of break-in year. And the 70s were an extraordinary time for humanistic psychology. It was really burgeoning everywhere. Everybody was interested in humanistic psychology. Everybody wanted to have a go at humanistic psychology. There were growth centers opened all over the place and so forth. The whole idea of a growth center is a humanistic psychology idea, somewhere where you could go and get therapy and stuff without having to be sick or ill or needy or anything like that. So there's only one left in London. There's the Open Centre in London is still there, Growth Centre, still functioning. So it was an exciting time because everybody was interested in humanistic psychology, and in fact famous Americans came over from Esalen and did a huge presentation of the Inn on the Park in Park Lane, and attracted a lot of attention and the newspapers and everything and so forth. And at that time I was a member of a group who were interested in politics and therapy, and we decided that this wasn't a great idea, so we went to them, talked to them and said, we want you to put on a cheap show in Paddington. We've got a nice hall where people come, and a huge number came to the Inn on the Park. Much smaller number compared to the free one in Paddington. But we put it on, and they agreed to it, and they did it, and they were good sports, and we all sort of mucked in together. And I went on getting more and more, going to more and more groups. I went to Gestalt groups, person-centered groups, psychodrama groups, you name it, I went to it, and I even went to a Tavistock group, which was a horrible experience. I wrote it up in the form of 38 poems, that I then delivered to the scientific papers of the British Psychological Society as a piece of existential research. This was a... And then at the same time, I was getting interested in politics. We had the first radical psychology conference in Keele University in the early 70s, and organized by a guy called Keith Payton, who later renamed himself as Keith Motherson. And we were really involved in... we used to infiltrate... BPS conferences and go to sessions on conditioning rats, and we would cause trouble and explain to them in words of one syllable that doing experiments with rats would never tell you anything worth knowing about human being. And it was a crazy idea, wasn't it, in the first place, that by learning how to condition rats you could learn principles of learning that could then form psychological laws. They never did discover a psychological law. Nobody's ever discovered any psychological law. To call psychology a science seems to be quite ridiculous. There was a lot of political interest as well. There's a great growth centre in London called Quasitor, biggest growth centre in Europe. And they helped to organise a meeting, out of which came a group which I joined called Red Therapy. And Red Therapy was an unstructured, self-organising therapy group, which later became written up in a book called In Our Own Hands. Very good, very interesting book on how to run a self-help therapy group. All this political stuff is going on, and a magazine started called Red Rat, and then there was another later magazine called Humpty Dumpty, and I was helping to edit both of these journals, and also getting interested in co-counseling. And co-counseling was extraordinarily valuable to me because I didn't know what emotion was. I remember the first group I went to in Quasitor, and actually it was in a quite different place in those days. And we went round and said, how's everybody feeling now? And it came to my turn to say what I was feeling. I hadn't got the faintest idea what I was feeling. If I had vocabulary, I would have said, I feel blocked. But I didn't even have the vocabulary then. So co-counseling is very, very good at teaching you what a feeling is. And they concentrate a lot on teaching you what a feeling is. So I learned about feelings from them. I was also interested in feminism at the time. I was a member of the anti-sexist men's group. It doesn't exist anymore, unfortunately. But it was so exciting at the time that men could also be interested in feminism. So we started a magazine called Achilles Heel, dedicated to radical men ideas, and that lasted actually until the year 2000. And then at the end of the 70s, I discovered primal integration. Primal integration was an extraordinarily deep experience for me, and I went on to that and took great interest in that, took great part in that. So at the end of the 1970s, I've been through all this stuff, and I also knew about, of course, studied Maslow and the idea of self-actualization and so forth. And when I came to count up the 17 points of Maslow laid down as characteristics of the self-actualized person, I decided I was self-actualized. this led me to a dilemma then, because Maslow never said much about what happens after that. I was talking to a person at a party, and I said, you know, now that I'm self-actualized, I don't know what comes next. And she said, well, actually, there's a guy called Ken Wilber. I think he writes a bit like you, and I think you'd be interested in him. So I had a look at Ken Wilber. He was absolutely accurate about my progress so far. He was extremely accurate about where I'd been up to that point. So I thought, oh, well, maybe if he's accurate about where I've been, maybe he's accurate about where I have to go next. And so what he said was that I have to go on into something he calls subtle consciousness. Subtle consciousness, where you admit that you're a spiritual being. And so I didn't know quite how to start on that, but by coincidence, somebody came up to me and said, we're starting a moon group. Would you be interested in joining? So I joined this moon group, and it turned out to be education in Wicca and neo-paganism. So I did that for a couple of years and carried on with that. I also became then extremely interested in myth and legend and so on and so forth. And I in discovering this subtle level of consciousness where you admit that you're a spiritual being and you start being interested in gods and goddesses and archetypes and symbols and nature spirits and fairies and angels, all these kind of things. This became my study for the next few years. And this is very interesting because at that point I got very interested in Jung. Jung was one of the prime writers about the subtle. Him and Stan Sundrock, very, very important. Anybody who hasn't read Stan Sundrock's book on the unconscious doesn't know much about the unconscious, in my opinion. So, James Hillman and Joseph Campbell. Those are the four great writers on the subtle. Joseph Campbell, I got none of his books, including five enormous volumes of ancient mythology and stuff. James Hillman, I've got 14 of his books, and that's quite a dose of Hillman. Jung, I've got the collected works and the red book, and not all of the works, only the ones that came out in paperback, and some which I also bought second hand, including the index. So good to have the index. This idea of this thing that there's a subtle level of consciousness, which Jung knows a lot about, and together with the other people I mentioned, was a real introduction to me for Jung. And I found Jung a very fascinating figure, somebody I could really take an interest in. But he had nothing much to say, it seemed to me, about himself. It was all terribly vague. You see, Ken Wilber is a lovely man. He has doesn't shirk the idea of talking about the self. And what he says is that there is this mental ego. That's the one we're most familiar with. That's ordinary, everyday consciousness that believes in black and white thinking, scientific truth, this, that, and the other. All the correct things you're supposed to believe in our culture. But it's absolutely useless from the point of view of knowing who you are. Because you take all your ideas about who you are from other people. They know who you are, you do. So when you move on to what Wilber calls the central stage, he calls that because it's the stage at which we learn the idea of body-mind unity. And is also the stage at which we learn about dialectics and dialectical thinking, that sometimes things can be paradoxical, they don't all have to be simple. That's the stage at which we become existential, self-responsible people. It's the stage at which we become aware of ourselves as like the real self instead of some figment of somebody else's imagination. And so this level, what Wilber calls the central level, very often it's called the existential level, is extremely important. And it's very interesting that there's so much interest in Buddhism these days, but Buddhism has absolutely nothing to say about the central consciousness, about the existential consciousness. as far as they're concerned, everything below the subtle is the gross. The gross. They have no other word for it than the gross, and that's it. So Buddhism is useless from the point of view of understanding anything about self-actualization. You're never going to learn anything about self-actualization from the Buddhist. Forget about that.
I've met a few Buddhists in the room.
So he then says that the next level is the subtle level, and so we have the mental ego, we have the sensual self, we have the subtle self. The subtle self is more or less equivalent to the soul. Now, some people don't like the word soul. Like, and so I have. Some people don't like the word soul, and so I've got some synonyms: higher self, inner teacher, deep self, heart, transpersonal self, genius, daimon, guidance self, higher intuitive self, archetype of the self, guardian angel, wise being, bliss, savikalpa, luminosity, psychic center, and antaratma. So, if you don't like the word soul, you can use any of those other words instead. So, you have my permission. So, this is the subtle level, and Jung had a lot to say about the subtle level. He was very interested in it. He was interested in all this stuff about angels and devils and symbols and stuff like that, you know. But he was extraordinarily vague about it. And if you look at Jung's individuation, whereas self-actualization is quite a coherent story, and in fact, I've got here a lot of research has been done on self-actualization, and people used to be able to dismiss Maxwell because he never did any proper research. But since then, 8 well-established and accredited researchers have researched in various fields and have found exactly the same levels that Maslow found. And so the whole idea of self-actualization is now scientifically respectable and okay, and you don't have to worry about it. But Jung, nobody seems to have done that with individuation, as far as I can tell. And so individuation is a nice idea, but it doesn't mean a thing, as far as I'm concerned. I don't know what the fuck. What it means. I don't know what it means. It's obviously something to do with self-development, but it doesn't seem to have an end point. It doesn't seem to have any steps on the way either. So instead of having a mental ego, sensual self, subtle self, causal self, anything like that, you have individuation, which is sort of an extraordinarily broad, vague, self-developmental idea, which I don't know where the beginning of it is and what the end of it is.
Maybe we could open the floor up to questions.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah. Let's open the floor up.
I can sit down now.
Yeah.
Contentious remarks to be responded to? Richard.
Richard, nice to you. Do you think that Carl Jung would have called himself a humanistic therapist?
Would Jung call himself a humanistic therapist? No, I don't think he would, no. I think he would balk
that idea. And I think he would, I mean, he didn't even want to be a Jungian, never mind a humanistic therapist. I don't think he liked to be labelled at all. No.
Chris Robinson. Maybe I'm now an anti-Ken.
Can't hear.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm now an anti-Ken Wilber. As in the 60s, very, very influential taken by Ken Wilber. But it's all kinds of conceptualist.
Yeah,
he's a conceptualist. Ken Wilber's a conceptualist. And I'm so sorry, John, that in that wonderful moment when you didn't know what to do or where to go, you weren't allowed to believe that wonderful uncertainty. But Ken Wilber provided you with another conceptual ladder for the illusions that you thought you would climb up.
Yes, I've not come up from the illusion that I know where I am. I do think I know where I am, and Ken Wilber has helped me to know that.
Anybody else?
My name's Carol. I think you're just playing with us today. As you're stirring us up. This idea of the age and stage of the developmentalist approach of the humanistic, I'm a humanistic, but I've also studied Jung, and what I find refreshing, particularly in working in child development, is that it does not have to be a progressive model, and that you can regress and fluctuate, and life is a flux. The idea of you just being stuck because you've got another ladder, it's amusing, but I'm glad you've opened up the two perspectives. And it's not about, you know, progression or hierarchy, as Leslie says. It's more Jungian and the circumambulation of fluctuation for me.
Well, that's you. I'm different.
Welcome to me. Welcome to me.
Any more?
Brilliant. I mean, behind all the humour, this is a very intense discussion.
Hello. I'm Beatrice, still a person-centred therapist, and an absolute acolyte of Ken Wilber. I love his, well, not an acolyte, but I love his writing, and many times in my life he's provided a secure and comprehensive framework for my experience of life. However, he is a white, middle-class man, and I am not surprised that you recognise so clearly your progression in what he was writing, because he was writing from that perspective. And I think he also looks at everything else, but I don't think it takes away from the fact that it is much more easy to recognise yourself in his work if you are also a white middle-class man.
Yes, you're probably right. I'm not as keen on Wilber as I used to be, because I think he's got much too complicated nowadays. But, you know, I found him useful at the time, and it was useful to me in that particular moment.
I'd like to go back to the idea of individuation. And you're saying you can't understand it. And I was thinking how Jung and Wilber, in fact, were quite anti-reductionist. And so it's not really about a cognitive understanding. Having been through a Jungian analysis, I think I understand it, but in a way that won't deliver itself in a scientific definition or something. I think it's more of an experience. And although Jung didn't say this, and I came to understand it as a type of process that only ends when you die, or maybe not, maybe it continues on.
that individuation, it hasn't got an end point necessarily. It's just a process that we're continuously in. That's my understanding from my experience, as I said.
Well, my question to you is, are you individuated?
I'm in process.
Well, it doesn't seem to me to be a good definition, because I don't know where you are at all. It doesn't tell me where you are. It just tells me, yes, you're you. I can see that.
This lady here has got the microphone.
Andrew, this lady has already got it.
Yes, I know.
And then, yes.
What about individuation as a process to find out what self means to you?
Well, I think there are different levels of self. You know, I have a mental ego self still, which I use quite often, going shopping or something like that. I've got a centaur self, which I use when I'm talking to you, or to clients, or to some human being that I want to be close to. And I've got the subtle self, which I go into when I pray, and when I try to get in contact with higher powers or the more colourful regions of the world, consciousness. I've also got causal self, where I believe that everything is one, and therefore there are no problems anywhere. How can there be a problem if everything is one? I've also got a non-dual self, who thinks that all that is rubbish, and you needn't even worry about it.
You've written quite a lot in your books about different ways of working with those different levels of self.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could say something about how you choose how to work at any particular point or with any particular individual from that huge range of quite often sort of contradictory ways of approaching personal interview.
Well, it's all about the client. I listen to clients and hopefully become aware of where they are in the scheme of things, and talk to them on that level, communicate with them on the level that they are ready to hear, and so it's a matter of readiness. What is the client ready for?
Last question from Moira.
Thanks. John, I just wanted to go back to the exchange between you and Helena.
Yeah.
What I was wondering was, I wonder where you need to know where she is. Individuation is a journey. A lot of it is unknown, and it's the kind of journey where actually you don't know where you're going, and it unfolds. And as I think Helena says, maybe it never ends. But I couldn't understand why you needed to know where she was.
Well, all I'm saying is I don't respect that. I don't think that's a good answer. I don't respect it because it seems vague and endless, and you can chop it any way you like, and nobody would ever know the difference.
Yes, go on.
One of the things is, I feel a bit weird, actually, in this conversation. I do feel there's huge intensity of feeling. All systems of psychology and psychotherapy postulate the top state. For Freud, it was genitality. You know, for the object relations people, it's object constancy. For the Jungians, it's individuation. For Maslow, it's whatever it is, self-actualization, and Rogers too. And for Ken Wilber, it's the non-dual self. I'd like to draw you out on our compulsive tendency as psychological people, therapists and thinkers and writers, to have a greater or higher good. And to me, this feels very old-fashioned, kind of part of modernism, the idea that you would have a state of affairs that ends it. And that's the highest thing. I'm thinking about how the communists have socialism, or used to have socialism as their top thingy. And why do we do this? I mean, is it just that this is how it is, and therefore we can't do otherwise than valorize one thing? Or is it something we've imposed on the psyche?
I just find it very useful in therapy. I find it very useful in therapy to know where the client is in the scheme of things. For example, a lot of clients come to me, mental ego level of development, and very often I find myself easing them into the central state, easing them into the next level of development, because the mental ego level is so limited and so weird in a way. It's so black and white and so bound by social conventions that I do find myself, every time they mention something that's more flexible, more dialectical, more open, more personal, I find myself encouraging that or fostering that. I think it's useful to me to know where I am and where the client is in the scheme of things, so that we can move in the right direction.
I think this is one of the many differences perhaps we're dealing with today. But thank you, John.
Okay.
We then have to move on.